What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whiteley, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Search up Polytalk in your favorite podcast app to listen.
This is an ABC podcast.
No ia e Māori, hello and get the one talk. Nissan Burivinaka and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Well, today on the show, Hawaiian Senator speaks out on the new travel restrictions against Tongans to the US as draconian. A TikTok user advocates for the well-being of palm scheme workers, and Christmas Island's been consumed by plastics. More on that and other stories here on Pacific Beat, where we come to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. I'm your host, Aggie DeBoe, and I say me taki ma'ata. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat. Ours are yours in the Pacific. Firstly, a Hawaiian senator has described as draconian new travel restrictions against Tongans coming into the United States. The restrictions came into effect on January 1st and effectively suspends applications for short-term tourism and student exchange visas. The White House has said the restrictions are justified because of the high rate of Tongans overstaying their visas. The US is home to the largest number of Tongans outside of Tonga, and many students come to study in Hawaii. Hawaiian State Senator Jared Keokalole says the problem of overstayers could be solved another way. The restrictions will have wider and negative consequences. Here he is speaking with Whinau Whanua.
The basis for Tonga being placed on the list was the number of Tongan nationals who reside in the United States who have overstayed their visas. That's a problem that can be solved through diplomatic relations with the Kingdom of Tonga. We need not enact these draconian restrictions that have all sorts of triggering consequences that potentially impact the civil rights of not only Tongans, but of Pacific Islanders who reside across the United States. These are dangerous times in the United States, and it's the implementation of these types of policies without any sort of forethought of how they will impact people in communities is the big problem that I see and that makes us all very uncomfortable in Hawaii.
Racial profiling, it seems it has been effectively legalized by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Earlier this year, the United States Supreme Court ruled in a case regarding President Trump's use of ICE, or the Immigrations and Customs Enforcement Agents. And essentially what they said is that contrary to the law in other law enforcement contexts, that when ICE is conducting immigration enforcement, they are allowed to take into account a person's skin color, mannerisms, speech in their investigations. And so the big problem I have with that coming from Hawaii is that if Tonga is now on the list of countries that are restricted from entering the United States, then basically what the law now allows is for ICE agents to stop, investigate, detain, and potentially arrest anyone that they think resembles a Tongan national, regardless of whether that individual has legal status and regardless of whether they're even Tongan. And so there is now, I think, a really concerning potential for vast numbers of people who look of Pacific Island descent to potentially be caught up in ICE enforcement. They have cause if they are not able to differentiate a Tongan from another Pacific Island ethnicity, they have cause to potentially stop anyone who looks in their view to be of Tongan descent.
And we've seen social media videos out of mainland America, controversial arrests and so forth. Are we seeing that in Hawaii? Is there
Absolutely. So I'm also running for, I'm a state senator, I'm running for United States Congress right now. And one of the reasons why is the incumbent who I'm running against refused to sign on to a letter condemning a raid that took place on the island of Maui earlier this summer, where ICE agents kicked down the door of a house that was full of public school teachers who were all of Filipino descent because they looked like Filipino nationals who may not have appropriate immigration status. Every single member of that residence either had a valid visa or in one case was a U.S. citizen. They didn't ask any questions. They didn't knock on the door to announce who they were. At 6 o'clock in the morning, they kicked the door down in a SWAT team style raid. They pulled everyone out of that house in their pajamas, threw them on the ground in the middle of the street in that neighborhood, and handcuffed them. And then over the next several hours, proceeded to determine whether they had cause to detain them. And so we don't need that kind of terrorism in our communities, especially coming from the United States government, especially if it's just on the basis of skin color.
From a geopolitical point of view, the U.S.'s influence in the Pacific region, do you think this is problematic?
Absolutely. There's a great power competition in the Pacific right now. This is not the type of posturing that I think works to foster closer ties with the United States and other Pacific Island nations. And so you have two really problematic consequences from this change in policy. One is the potential for a deterioration of relations throughout the Pacific. And the other is for residents and lots of Pacific Islander citizens of the United States who have constitutionally guaranteed civil rights to have those rights impeded by this draconian policy that's been put in place by the Trump administration.
How do you feel about Trump's role in America so far? Are you deeply concerned about the next 2 years?
I think it's been a complete disaster. When you look at what has just happened in Venezuela, I think that was a triggering event for many people in Hawaii, especially indigenous native Hawaiians, who look at the United States government's move to replace a head of state of another country and essentially claim that they are now taking control of the country in order to extract resources from them. That triggers deep sensitivities in Hawaii, given the fact that the United States did that to Hawaii in a period of imperialism that the country experienced in the 1890s.
And that was Hawaiian State Senator Jared Keokalole.
What's up, ABC Radio Australia listeners? I'm Sosafina Formoli, and I want you to come hang with me for On The Record, your weekly deep dive into the music that moves the Pacific. We'll talk about the big tracks that inspire your favourite Pacific music artists and the real stories behind them. Plus, we'll uncover some gems that you might not know yet, keeping the heart of the Pacific alive and thumping. Catch On The Record Mondays at 3 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Dubon. Now, working in a new country can be hard. Adapting to a new culture, navigating a different language, and living away from home. For the more than 30,000 workers in the Pacific Australia Labour Mobility, or PALM scheme, it's a daily reality. But as Lucy Cooper discovered, everyday Australians are stepping up to support workers when they fall through the cracks.
Bula vanaka, everyone. I have a newsflash for everyone.
Every night, Crystal Beauchamp goes live on TikTok.
PALM workers keep Australia moving.
But with more than 29,000 followers and over 100,000 likes, Crystal uses her platform to advocate for Pacific Island workers in Australia's PALM scheme.
I share awareness, I educate them, and every day we have a different topic to talk about. Maybe it might be about work rights, like last night. or the previous night was all about visas, so student visas, partner visas, and it's just a different topic every night.
A qualified support worker, the Fijian Australian, shares information with the hope it will reduce exploitation in the scheme.
I tell everyone that I'm an independent volunteer community advocate. The bonus part is, yes, I'm qualified. We talk about drink driving. We talk about beach safety. A lot of questions is around visas. There is so many visa confusions.
She sources her information from the Australian Department of Home Affairs website, with up to 200 users watching her live stream every night.
The workers do have access to most of the information that obviously I'm giving them. There's all the Facebook pages that the department, that Palm Scheme, obviously have created. Look, I don't know the difference between myself and reading a post, but I think that they want someone to give it to them in simple English. I think they want someone to engage with them. On average, I'm getting about 10 to 20 messages from random people and about probably five workers every night just asking simple questions.
Crystal said wrongful termination and visa questions are the two main topics workers contact her about.
So sad to see these workers. Like, I had 10 workers terminated before Christmas. How do you even process that? I had one worker from Vanuatu, and her boss at the farm was very, very, very atrocious. And listening to her experience for 7 years on that farm, I don't know how she lasted 7 years, to be honest, because the boss would tell them stuff like, you know, why are you drinking water? Why are you taking a break? Every minute that you take is money that I have to pay. And this is on a daily basis. And when the labour hire did shut down, the boss actually threatened her and all that.
Crystal isn't alone in wanting to help and support Palm Scheme workers. Tam Chinnery and her husband own a plantation on the banks of the Gascoyne River in Carnarvon, about 980 kilometres north of Perth.
We're only a small plantation, so we grow citrus and a range of Asian veggies.
A few years ago, they employed two women from the Solomon Islands, Christina and Justina, to work on their farm.
When you go through the process of becoming an employer, an accredited employer, you've really got to make this massive commitment to their welfare and well-being and their accommodation, but not just that, their social life and their any religious activities they want to undertake. So it's a huge thing, but we were up for it.
Tam helped them set up their bank accounts, tax file numbers, health insurance, as well as purchase phones. When both workers left Australia, they asked to access their superannuation. Christina had a smooth experience and received the money. Justina waited a few months before accessing her super, having to wait for her visa to expire.
We found out because the superannuation had been dormant for so long, the superannuation had been handed over to the Australian Taxation Department. So after wading through tons and tons of reading, we found out that the Australian Taxation Department would not send money to an overseas bank account. So it had to be an Australian bank account.
What ensued for Tam, who wanted to help Justina, was more than 6 months of roadblocks.
They all speak Solomon Islands Pidgin. You know, they read basic English, but they don't comprehend fairly complex English, especially the types of English and dot points and nuances of what's on the Australian Taxation Department. The other thing is, of course, they don't have the internet. So, you know, when you ring a lot of these agencies, they say, oh, just tell them to fill out the online form. Well, the word just is really oversimplifying the whole process because they can't just get online and do that. These girls were fortunate because their uncle or their brother-in-law had a computer and was reasonably computer savvy in that he could use email. But even he was absolutely flummoxed at the form that the Australian Tax Office wanted him to fill in.
After receiving advice and a direct number to call Commonwealth Bank, Tam told Justina to call the bank from the Solomon Islands, a costly exercise.
It cost them over 300 Solomon dollars to make that phone call because they did get the royal runaround, and that's probably 3 weeks' wages for Justina.
Justina has since received the money into her account, but Tam said it shouldn't take a volunteer, an everyday Australian, to have to solve these issues.
What gets my goat is there's all these wonderful expressions of how wonderful all these schemes are, But the reality of it is that some of these people, a lot of them, must be absolutely taken to the cleaners by the employers and also taken to the cleaners by the Australian system that doesn't assist them at all. How the heck can we sort of justify making it so damn difficult for them to access their what they rightfully should be able to get hold of? They come here in good faith.
It's a situation which has opened Tam's eyes to just how difficult it can be working under the PALM scheme in Australia.
It tells me that there's a lot of ignorance in Australia, and especially in the Australian banking system, the Australian Taxation Office, even the PALM scheme people themselves, even though they very genuinely try to help, they're very limited through their policies and protocols to being able to help.
Crystal Beauchamp said the fact PALM workers contact her every night asking for advice is indicative that there is a lack of support provided by the government.
I think that the support that is given is not really taken seriously. Like, there are obviously country liaison officers and you've got your community connections, but I really don't think that they're taking their positions very seriously and actually building a rapport with these workers. Maybe they need to look and restructure how they employ the kind of the support. Maybe it's more support workers instead of country liaison officers, because it's not really, it's not getting out there.
And that's Crystal Beauchamp, qualified support worker who uses TikTok to support PALM scheme workers. Ending that story from Lucy Cooper. Well, kia ora and welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to Samoa, where the head of state, Tuimalialii Whanau Vaeletoa Sulauvi II, has proclaimed a ban on construction on Sundays. In a statement over the weekend, he also proclaimed a national period of prayer and fasting beginning Sunday and running through to the 16th of January. The proclamation, endorsed at the request of Prime Minister Lauli Alimaliatsole Otea Schmidt, with the cabinet and church leaders also mandating weekly prayers and fasting every Wednesdays across government ministries, corporations and statutory bodies. So on the line to give her reaction to these new laws is Samoan veteran journalist and Professor of Pacific Island Studies at Portland State University, Langi Boiva Sherelle Jackson. With that, I say malo le soifua, Langi. Welcome to the show.
Malo soifua, Malangi, ma agi. Great to hear that ABBA to start off the day.
So it was a great song.
Made me feel like I was in the bus in Savai.
That's it. Yeah, definitely. Well, look, right. I mean, speaking on things that are happening in, you know, the homeland in Samoa is, you know, these new religious laws that have been proclaimed by the head of state. I mean, is this something rare or common?
You know, this is actually very common. It's done before by former Prime Minister Tuila Epa Sailele. You know, Samoa is a Christian country, and so it's not unheard of to have these types of bans on Sundays and also prayer week and fasting.
I mean, and this obviously coincides with a lot of things that the Samoan Prime Minister is doing at the moment. It seems to be top agenda. There's these new religious policies. Again, he's considered the banning of even non-Christian countries from Samoa. Also recently, the announcement of an establishment of an embassy in Jerusalem. I mean, I want to maybe take a look back to his election time. Was this actually really part of what he was running on during his election campaign?
Very much so. The current Prime Minister, Lauli Alimaliatoa, is very much, you know, ran on the platform of Christianity and of, you know, faith-based voting. And so, therefore, it is not a surprise that this is happening. The surprise is, of course, the embassy in Jerusalem. That I do not recall him mentioning that specifically. And also just the way in which all of these national policies are unfolding around the same time. But, you know, Aggie, it's not unheard of for Samoa to do this in January, the start of the new year. So I'm not surprised that this is happening, but at the same time, the way that it's unfolding and all of these measures put in place at the same time is, you know, it's very concerning.
So do you feel it's a bit of a rash, you know, law that they're trying to go ahead with? What does this even equate to?
I just find it interesting that it's so long. There have been fasting periods declared before, like, you know, not unheard of that we go to on a Manu Samoa game, say we make it to the quarterfinal, semifinals, you know, a proposal to have a fasting period to all together cheer for the boys. That's been done before. Or if there's a cyclone or something of a national emergency, there is usually a declaration of a fasting period or a prayer period. This going into it seems very radical in approach, and it seems to be the way that the current prime minister is approaching national policy from a very religious-based perspective.
Mm. How much do you think, though, Langiboiva, that you know, these new laws will impact Samoa, maybe in terms of even its image and its economy?
I think the impact, so with the construction ban on Sunday, Aggie, the people who will be affected by that are the Chinese companies.
Right.
So because Samoans already don't work on Sundays except for, you know, service workers like the supermarkets, you know, the essential workers, hospitals and so forth. But the construction workers who work on Sundays are Chinese construction workers. And, you know, more recently they have been hiring Samoans. So those Samoans have also been working with those companies. So the biggest hit will be on Chinese construction companies. So it will have an impact on, say, projects or, you know, national projects. But at the same time, I wonder if exceptions are made so that Chinese workers can still work. Because those exceptions were made to have them work to start with under Tuila Ipa's leadership. So this is very interesting. In terms of the reputation of Samoa, naturally, you know, his decisions to, you know, visibly take a stance on the, you know, the Palestinian and Israeli issue will definitely have an impact. If you look at Samoa's engagement at the UN, it has been conservative in nature. So him going full force into, you know, into the Jerusalem embassy and his view on supporting one side of this particular international crisis, you know, it certainly will have an impact on Samoa's, you know, international relations, but also Samoa's reputation worldwide.
Does this paint then, or does this make Samoa look like it's a theocracy?
I think there's certainly, you know, scholars and experts who are leaning towards that perspective. But I think, you know, this is some of the most, how should I say this? You know, this is the beginning of some of his most stringent policies so far. And so time, you know, give it a bit more time to see how far he leans into his policies, religious-based policies, and then we shall see.
Mm. Yeah, I think often, Langi, because obviously with even my Tongan background, I know growing up, same thing, right? You have a week of prayer, there is fasting and things like that at the first week of the year. So it's probably not surprising for many a Pacific people. Is this more of just how the Western world is going to view the Pacific, especially Samoa, with the things that the Prime Minister is doing?
I mean, it's, you know, the Pacific has been heavily influenced by Christianity and by religion over the years with, you know, like you said, how you've experienced that in Tonga. This is the same throughout Polynesia. There's different types of religions who have so much power in government. So what we have seen with Lauli's leadership is that certainly he has been very much focused on, you know, on his stance on religion. There have been, you know, certainly religious protocols that have been observed by him in our parliament that have never been observed before. So that has raised some concerns among other Samoans, but at the same time, it has also largely received a lot of support from his followers. So it is a very interesting time for Samoa, but, you know, it's still concerning for many because religious freedom is part of, you know, any democratic government, and it seems that there is a push towards one way under his leadership.
Mm. And so, and that's the thing, you talk about the concern. Are you concerned then that there will be possibly more laws in the future under this government?
I mean, with any leaning towards certain religious extremes, you know, the first thing you worry about are the rights of women, freedom of the press, and rights of people to protest, and many rights that are affiliated with, you know, with just right to life and so forth in a democratic government. The concern there is, how much will he lean into some of these religious beliefs and principles that he holds, and will he take it that far?
Well, it is definitely, like you said, it's a bit of a wait and see as to, you know, how far this goes. But look, Langi Boiva, it is always great to catch up with you. Really appreciate your insight into the situation.
Thank you so much, Aggie.
Thank you. Whaftaitere lava. That, of course, is Samoan veteran journalist and professor of Pacific Island Studies at Portland State University. Langi Boiva, Sherelle Jackson.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics, and how does it affect us? Each week, Politalk dives straight into the tough questions, like what happens if a World War II shipwreck ruptures and unleashes thousands of litres of oil into our ocean.
Across the Pacific, there's around 3,800 of these World War II shipwrecks, which are potentially polluting.
On Politalk, Tuesdays, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bon dia and welcome back to Pacific Beat. It is that time where we head around the region to get the latest headlines, and that's always brought to you by our producer, Whenau Whonua, who's sitting with me in the studio this morning. Whewhe hake.
Saibe hake.
You had a good weekend?
Yeah.
I know, it's, the weather was pretty hot, wasn't it?
It was very, very hot. It got up to 44 in some parts of Victoria, on, I believe it was on Friday.
Yeah. Yes. But unfortunately, of course, in regional Victoria, we've experienced a lot of fires, haven't we, bushfires?
Ongoing bushfires, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us this morning. We're going to start in Fiji. There's a temporary closure of Nandi International Airport. That's resulted in flight diversions to Samoa. Gosh, can you tell us what's happening there?
Yes, according to the Fiji Times, Fiji Airways flight from Sydney to Nandi was diverted to Apia over the weekend due to the temporary closure of Nandi International Airport, which was experiencing issues with its runway lights. Reports indicate a power outage or malfunction affected the runway lights, forcing the diversions. And there were flights diverted to Nausori and one to Samoa. 343 passengers on board that flight that were diverted to Apia, and all are believed to have since transited to their original destinations.
Nice. Hey, look, it was a divert, better that than anything else, and that all of the passengers are safe. So good to hear on that. We shared the story last week. Now, this is the update of two victims of a shooting at a Tongan funeral in Utah. They've actually been named. What's the details there, Whenau?
Yes, the two men are Vaya Tuliki Hihifo and Sione Vatuvei. There were the two men killed outside a memorial service last week in Salt Lake City, Utah, which has captured headlines in news agencies across the United States. There were six injured in that shooting. But one of the victims, 46-year-old Vaya Tuliki Hihifo, he's a father of 12.
Wow.
A GoFundMe page has been put up. The two men, the full details of why these shootings occurred are yet to be released. But according to Salt Lake City Police, the shooting occurred between funeral goers and outside the memorial service. So both victims.
Wasn't a random attack, was it?
It wasn't a random attack. But the reasons for why it occurred is yet to be revealed, and the people responsible are yet to be arrested as well. Police saying it's an ongoing investigation.
Yeah, well, we will keep our eyes and ears on that story and try and bring you the latest on that. We head to Papua New Guinea. Opposition MPs blasting government over ongoing teacher entitlement crises. What's happening here?
Yes, so according to reports, local reports, Papua New Guinea opposition leader James Nomone has accused the government of repeatedly failing the country's teachers. He says more than 63,000 educators serving nearly 13,000 schools have been left to struggle without basic entitlements owed to them by the government. He says there's been neglect through unpaid leave fares, delayed salaries, and outstanding retirement and repatriation benefits. And says this is a problem that's persisted for years. And he's urged government to take action to help assist the teachers. And he called on Prime Minister James Morape to act immediately, proposing emergency funding within 2 weeks to clear outstanding entitlements.
That's crazy. Look, we will have to try and see if we can get someone to speak about that too, in regards to proposing emergency funding, right? That's what they're trying to do.
Yes.
Okay. Fino, as always, really appreciate you coming through to bring us the latest headlines from across the region here on Pacific Beat. Well, as you would have heard, that's your headlines from around the region. But it's a great time to do a recap on what's been on the show so far. At the beginning of the show, we heard Hawaiian Senator speaking out on the new travel restrictions against Tongans to the US as draconian. Also, a TikTok user advocates for the well-being of Palm Scheme workers. But still to come, we've got Christmas Island turning into Plastic Island, and that there's frustration over funding not yet released because of Samoa's Prime Minister not signing a deal. All of that here on Pacific Beat.
Want to catch up or listen again to your favourite ABC Radio Australia programs anytime, anywhere? From Pacific Beat to Stories from the Pacific, Nijin Footy to Culture Compass. You can listen to your top shows on your favourite podcast app on the go and for free. Just search for your favourite ABC Radio Australia program in your podcast app and press play. ABC Radio Australia. Bringing you more ways to listen.
Malo Dalma e Bombongini. I'm your host, Aggie Tupou, and this is Pacific Beat. To the world of sport, the chair of the Fijian Rugby Union, John Sande, is not opposed to the idea of world rugby intervening if it means the impasse in Samoa, which is blocking the path to $150 million in Australian government money, can be resolved. Now, the funds are due to be split between the Fijian, Samoan and Tongan unions, but Prime Minister Lauri is refusing to sign off on the deal until former Prime Minister Tuilaepa is out of the picture as chair of Lakapi Samoa. Once the money is made available, the word is that it would pave the way for all three unions to field a team in a revamped Super Rugby Oz competition. So right now, John Sande is understandably frustrated.
Well, we were at the meeting in Perth where we all resolved that's the direction we're going to go with, along with Rugby Australia. And we would then work together to get the proposal signed and put through the pathways to the Australian government. The delay is frustrating, yes. We would like to see it signed and delivered. How it is being dealt with in Samoa, that's for the Samoan Union to work through. We will continue to provide all the support that they need so that we could get it over the line. And if need be, if we from Fiji and Tonga to make a goodwill visit to try and speed things up, we'll do it. But at the moment, we're relying on the processes within the Samoan community and the Samoan rugby family to get the signature done so we could move on with this. But the other option is where two out of the three have signed, we can continue to move the process based on the understanding that at some point in the future, some more will come on board. So that also is a conversation that's continuing on the margins.
Do you think there is good reason for World Rugby to get involved here? Because essentially, your union is at the mercy of a political spat between the Prime Minister and a former Prime Minister. And yet, there's not meant to be any political involvement in the running of unions in the Pacific. And you know how that can affect you, because when you arrived at the Fiji Union, there was still political involvement until the Prime Minister took it away. And there's now a distance between yourselves and government.
That's right. And that's a fair point. And I think, you know, the whole process is being driven from Rugby Australia, and we would be guided by how Rugby Australia wants it done. It would be good if World Rugby could intervene. But I think at this stage, it would be best that Fiji and Tonga continue to work with within our processes to get them going. It's a deep political question, which I don't really want to step into. I'm more just interested in the rugby side of things. If we can work to get like a piece or more to move on, we would be happy to help in any way we can.
Presuming the impasse can be resolved and the money is released, then my understanding is this would mean that Fiji could field essentially a development Andrea side, if you like, in what is called Super Rugby Oz. Do I have that right?
That is something that's been talked about. We haven't had any formal approach put to the board, but I think that's the general direction it looks like it's going to end up in, and we would be happy to support that effort because we get all our financial support from the Australian taxpayer through the Australian government, and we would be happy to be involved in that initiative and to support it as much as possible.
And in terms of the future development of the Undura, if that were to be the case, that would be another important piece in the puzzle, wouldn't it, to have that development side feeding through to the senior side?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think from the licensing and contractual positions, if that Super Rugby Oz did break away, we, you know, the current Drua license would remain with Rugby New Zealand, and we would have to field another franchise with Super Rugby Oz. And we are already looking at scenarios in how we could be positioning ourselves for that. Most probably will be from the pool of players that are playing in the Skipper Cup. You know, we've tried to raise the standard of that, and it's been probably one of the best and most successful Skipper Cup campaigns in decades. And that's all part of the development and growth so that we could then be ready for that when that eventually comes up.
The union is looking for a new coach for Fijiana and the Fijiana Undrua, and also head of women's high performance, as I understand it. Were these two vacancies coming on top of each other anticipated, or has the union been caught out to some extent?
No, we haven't been caught out. These vacancies have arisen from the adoption of our 10-year strategic plan. What has happened in between is more just transitional issues, nothing more than that. On the issue of head coach, Ewan Cunningham, an offer was made to him. He came back with a counter-offer, which we accepted. He reflected on it, family commitments back home. He has a young family and distance involved. He has asked to be relieved from the negotiations so that he can go back to Wales to be with his young family at a very important time in their lives as they go through middle school and higher education. So we have accepted that, and we have wished him well. We have left on great terms. We would have gone to the end of the world to keep him because he has done a fantastic job.
Were you aware, though, that despite the reasons he gave for wanting to head back to the UK, that he was about to land a job with Scotland, or is that just coincidental?
It's a free market, and we respect his wish to chase other opportunities. If he had applied for other positions, that's the way business is, and we respect that.
I detect from what you said that you clearly were disappointed that you lost him, because Fijiana went to the World Cup last year and did a very good job and looked to be competing more effectively against bigger nations than perhaps they have in the past. But you've not only lost your head coach, but you've lost your head of high performance as well. I mean, heading into a new year, how damaging potentially could this be for the development of the women's game? Because clearly there's going to be a gap now until you can find two replacements.
Yeah, I mean, all unions around the world go through this. It usually happens after every World Cup because, you know, usually the appointments are from World Cup to World Cup cycles, and coaches and the support staff that have been with teams for several cycles usually then end up choosing to leave to explore new horizons. And that has been the same with our GM, Women's High Performance. She has been a fantastic asset with us. She's done a lot of great work. And the time had come that she wanted to explore new horizons, because at the same time, we've also, as is part of our 10-year strategic plan that we have just recently adopted, the whole configuration of Fiji Rugby has had to start to be reshaped to fit in with where we want to go. And, you know, maybe it doesn't fit with something, and that's fine. We respect that. But where we want to go, the General Assembly has endorsed, so we are heading in that direction.
And that there is John Sunday, chair of the Fiji Rugby Union, with what already looks like a busy year ahead of him. He was talking to Richard Hewitt there.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tinirau Arona.
Well, do you reckon just on that one, I could get a gig with your commentary?
I know. You know what? I have to get you to say the names first. Say the names first. You get the pronunciations right, you're in.
The numbers in, mate.
You're in.
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. We head to the remote Australian territory of Christmas Island, which has been home to some of the country's most prized and beautiful beaches. But plastic discarded by consumers thousands of kilometres away has threatened the idyllic landscape. It's something the United Nations has tried and so far failed to deal with through a plastics treaty. So residents of Christmas Island are using their own creative means to address the problem, as Alistair Bates reports.
The problem is as relentless as the tides.
You can remove thousands of kilos of plastic and
the next day it's back.
On Christmas Island, a remote shore carves into the cliff face to create a hidden tropical paradise. Known as Greta Beach, it is a nesting ground for green sea turtles and one of the few places in Australia where they lay eggs year-round. But during the dry season, it is also coated in rubbish. Local Lynn Gaff says it's left the turtles with an obstacle course of plastic shards, nylon twine and discarded thongs.
It's a constant battle for them. It's heartbreaking to see them, all of their attempts fail. So they will start trying to dig a belly pit and then they hit tons of plastic that's below the surface.
Lynn has watched the plastic accumulate at Greta Beach for decades. She volunteers on regular cleanup missions, but the battle never seems to end.
It's shocking for people who visit to see the rubbish there. They're just like, how could this happen? Because there's not a lot of places in Australia where that would be acceptable.
Much of the waste doesn't come from Australia. Only about 2% originates from Christmas Island and the mainland combined. The rest is dumped here by ocean currents, mainly from Indonesia and Malaysia. And so the burden falls on Christmas Island's 1,700 residents. Last year alone, they removed more than 2.8 tonnes of rubbish.
The things that you can see are just the tip of the iceberg into what's actually in the ocean.
Kyoto University Associate Professor Saskia Abrams-Kovanenko says microplastics are an even bigger problem.
They get into oceanic ecosystems and cause a lot of damage.
She believes a global plastics treaty is essential to stop the flow of rubbish, but talks between 185 countries unravelled last August. In the meantime, Christmas Islanders are reckoning with the vastness of the issue in a special way.
Should we work on that next week?
Through their art.
It's a free material. It's also helping clean the beach while we go down there. But it tells a huge story.
Artist in residence Cecile Williams is putting together a community exhibition inspired by the contrast of an island that is mostly pristine national park and one of Australia's most polluted beaches. The showcase is being prepared in the art room of Christmas Island District High School, where the shelves are stacked with forgotten toys, bottles and polystyrene fished from the waves.
It is shocking, but I think the more people can make and talk about it, the more it gets out into the world.
For students like Sophia Retelik, the chance to turn trash into treasure is a spot of hope among the sea of plastic.
I'll go out with my mum to Greta Beach and we'll be like collecting the little plastics. It's very cool to see what like you can make from the beach.
And that's student Sophia Redelick ending that report from Alistair Bates. Let's take a look at back at one of our main stories today. Samoa's head of state, Tui Malealii Whanau Va'aletoa Suilauvi II, has proclaimed a ban on construction on Sundays, with weekly prayer and fasting also being announced.
I'm not surprised that this is happening, but at the same time, the way that it's unfolding and all of these measures put in place at the same time, it's very concerning.
And that's Samoan veteran journalist Lingboiva Sherelle Jackson. Find those stories when you type Pacific Beat or Radio Australia into your search engine. The team will be back same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time, but you can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. at PNG time. Up next with ABC Radio Australia is your news, and coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. Until next time, Adua Afatu. This is Agito Bo on Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.